Every president of the United States has had some influence on all of America, but few have had the influence on this part of the country than Thomas Jefferson. His national importance is obvious. He can be associated with who we are and why we are. And today, his 274th birthday, we're going to be talking about him. We thought we'd wish him a happy birthday with one of our favorites, Peter Castor, professor of history at Washington University. So nice to have you back with us again.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
You said something interesting during that piece on the Millennium Mayor, that Mayor Slay was the only mayor that you've ever known the time that you've been
much.
In St. Louis.
Yeah. I mean, I arrived here in 98. He wasn't mayor then, but he's been mayor so long. I really identify him with my time here.
Well, he is making history with that record term. We're going to be talking about history today, Peter. You have to wonder what this area, this region would be like today had Thomas Jefferson not been president of the U.S.
Well, and it was a big part of Jefferson's time as president. The United States acquired the land that included Missouri in 1803, and he was in charge of governing it. Through his appointed subordinates for the rest of his administration. And then when Missouri was arguing for statehood, he was retired by then, but it was of great importance to him. And yeah, it's hard to know how things would have played out had Jefferson not been president. But one thing is clear, he was very much concerned with this place.
And because of the Louisiana Purchase, which was certainly a very, very big deal, opened up the entire Western United States.
Absolutely. And as I always tell everyone here, unfortunately, Thomas Jefferson didn't necessarily want us at the start when he was pursuing a Louisiana Purchase in 1803. He wanted to acquire New Orleans and the Gulf Coast, and the French instead imposed this agreement that was much larger and included all of this land, included St. Louis was a big concern, but the area that became Missouri. And Jefferson had to adapt to this. He said, how do we govern all of this land? And that became the most important domestic policy challenge he faced during his presidency.
All of which led to the Lewis and Clark expedition, mm-hmm. which was another very big deal, all at the instigation of Thomas Jefferson.
Absolutely. And Jefferson was planning to send that expedition before 1803, but he couldn't because the Spanish officials who governed here said, we're not going to let these American troops go through St. Louis and go up the Missouri River. And with the transfer of that land, the expedition was able to move forward. And actually, for Lewis and Clark, Missouri shaped the rest of their lives. Lewis was the second territorial governor. Clark was a long-serving territorial governor. He spent most of the rest of his life in Missouri. And Jefferson sent a series of these young Virginians to Missouri to govern this place. And they're actually just at the vanguard of a whole migration to this area. A lot of them were, in fact, Virginians. There are a lot of Virginians who populated Missouri.
Part of his rationale for this expedition also was his interest in so many different things, in the sciences. People don't realize perhaps how many different interests he had, language, science. We both received something this morning, I believe, that I hadn't known, that part of this expedition was to look for live mastodons.
Exactly. I mean, it sounds nutty to us now, but in Jefferson's time, there was this evidence that there were these fossilized remains of what he thought was a mastodon, some enormous animal. Jefferson believed that North America was capable of producing great things. He said America would naturally produce a great republic in the form of the United States. It had great mountains, and he said it must have produced great animals. And it turns out the remains he saw actually wind up being a giant sloth. Mm-hmm. But you put it well. Jefferson had so many interests. He loved government. He was deeply interested, obviously, in government and politics. That's what most people know. But he had this deep interest in science, in language, in music. He played violin. He really did have wide-ranging interests.
I guess it shows you what can be accomplished when you don't have television.
Well,
you use your time for something else.
Well, it also shows what can be accomplished when you don't have to do any manual labor yourself, when you have hundreds of people who are doing all that physical labor for you. When you're and this is an important part of Jefferson's life as well. When you're born to wealth, when you have enslaved people around you who build your house, who maintain it, who cook your food, who do all of that for you, you can sit in the library all day and read. And when you don't have a cell phone to disturb you, more's the better.
Well, you're talking slavery here,
absolutely,
too, which is certainly a key point in all of this. Something that I had learned just recently and didn't know, that he practiced law before he got into public mm-hmm. life, and a number of his cases involved defending slaves.
Absolutely. So Jefferson has this complex relationship with slavery. And my colleague at Washington University, David Koenig, is writing a book about Jefferson's legal practice, and he's really piecing this together. And so there are times throughout his life when Jefferson sought to eliminate slavery in several ways and several forms, or to defend slaves who are suing for their freedom. But at the same time, he freed almost none of his own slaves. He sought to eliminate slavery in the Northwest Territory, but to preserve slavery in the Southwest. Mm. So he is as conflicted and conflicting on this as you can imagine.
And yet he treated his slaves, as I gathered, somewhat differently than most slave owners do. They talk of him as being, if this is an oxymoron of some sort, a benevolent slave owner.
Well, Jefferson certainly thought he was a benevolent slaveholder. And it would depend who you asked. So Jefferson, and this would be true on any large plantation. There would be slaves who were who might be serving in the main house, who might be treated quite well. And Jefferson, like many of his contemporaries, thought of these people as a kind of distant family. In some cases, they were literally part of his family. They were related to him. Then there were slaves working out in fields who are treated absolutely horribly. They're all enslaved, which is horrible. Jefferson also ran his plantation differently. He toyed around with various ways to try to make it profitable. He opens a small factory producing nails. And at the end of the day, he didn't run his plantation very well. George Washington, for example, ran a very profitable plantation. Thomas Jefferson really struggled to make his plantation profitable. And at the end of the day, he was unable to do so.
At the end of the day, meaning the end of his life, he was in dire financial straits.
Absolutely.
Wasn't
he? He was. He was in great debt. Many of his contemporaries were, at a time when the system of Virginia plantation agriculture was struggling. It was competing with other states. A lot of the fields were exhausted. There were real challenges in managing a plantation. And so when Jefferson died, he left his descendants in great debt. And in the immediate aftermath of his death, there's this desperate effort to try to settle all those debts. It's the reason why the plantation and the house at the center of it, Monticello, eventually left the family as a way to settle those debts.
Going back to the slavery issue for a moment, something I didn't know among the many things I can categorize that way, that there was an act in 1807 called the Prohibition of Importation of Slaves. I'd not heard of that, and he signed it.
Yeah. Now, the other reason, there are several acts that Jefferson signs on slave importation, some of which relate to here. So the first one, which you're referring to, is that what many people do know is the Constitution prohibited the elimination of slavery when it was ratified, but provided for the elimination of the foreign slave trade in 1807. Mm-hmm. And so that's the law Jefferson's signing in 1807. It's to put to an end the foreign slave trade. But in 1807, 1808, and 1809, there's actually a real crisis with this, because there are a large number of migrants from the Caribbean who are fleeing a variety of upheavals, and there are white migrants who bring with them their slaves. And so Jefferson allows this, what he sees as a compassionate relaxation of that law, to allow these refugees to bring their slaves with them. But Jefferson signs that into law because the Constitution's provided for it. Jefferson wrote repeatedly that, you know, he had this hope that eventually slavery would be eliminated, but he could not eliminate it in his own life. And as president, for example, governing Missouri, he created a system, a government system, that was designed to preserve slavery, to keep it solid. There was a system of slavery in Missouri working with, for example, Meriwether Lewis, who's the territorial governor. He said, we need a legal system that makes this a rational slave system, which sounds nuts to us now, but he would have described it that way. And his own belief was that slavery was part of this region and it needed to be preserved legally.
So is he a hypocrite?
This is what everyone argues about Thomas Jefferson. And you hear two schools of thought about it. One is he's complex and conflicted. The other is he is a hypocrite. And I'll admit I often steer away from that because he's also consistent in many ways. He's inconsistent in others. And I think that's actually part of the reason why people are so interested in Jefferson is everything that makes us American, every part of our troubled history, he's entangled in it all. He creates party politics. He both eliminates slavery in some areas, preserves it in others. He helps found the institutions of government. He's someone who claims he's against slavery, but he has children with one of his slaves, but then he won't free them. He's about as – the phrase people often use to describe something, it's complicated. There are a few people to whom that phrase applies more than to Thomas Jefferson.
But of course, many of the founding fathers fell into the same kind of category in the sense that they all had slaves.
Exactly. And the majority of presidents before the Civil War were slaveholders. That's actually part of what enabled them to pursue politics. But many of the first presidents, those great Virginia presidents, Washington, Jefferson, Madison, Monroe, every single one of them was a slaveholder. Jefferson was the one who wrote and spoke most often about slavery as a moral issue and as an issue of social policy. Jefferson is the one who more than anybody pushed to make the Northwest Territory – it's now Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Michigan – to provide for the elimination of slavery in those territories from his belief that, first of all, slavery was a moral evil. But Jefferson – it wasn't just that Jefferson could not free his own slaves. And when I say could not, it wasn't that someone entirely prevented him, but he could not disentangle himself from that. But also he sought and fought to preserve slavery in other areas. Many of his contemporaries simply didn't have that hand-wringing about it. They just said – slaveholders would say, yeah, slavery is a reality and it's what keeps me – it's my business. It's what I do.
Let's put slavery aside for just a moment for what I'm about to ask next, because we can consider, I suppose, what he did and the way he acted a weakness. Did he have any other weaknesses that you could point to and say, well, this guy wasn't perfect. He certainly did a lot for the country and was an intellectual and all the things that we've been talking about. But is there a but?
Well, nobody's perfect. And, and with Jefferson, especially nowadays, we are attuned to his weaknesses because for so long he was described as this kind of paragon of virtue. Yeah. And so quite rightly, people now say, oh, hold on. There's more to it than this. And of course, and what I'm going to describe now as weaknesses is what makes him interesting to me. And it's what makes him three-dimensional. Mm-hmm. So he could be vain. He was often at times very thin-skinned. He would take criticism very personally. As I said, he really was – he managed the nation's budget extremely well. He managed his personal budget extremely badly. Mm-hmm. All of these are weaknesses that he had. There are times when he's misled by people. He makes mistakes in the same way that anyone would. And, it's one of the reasons people talk about Jefferson now is, of course, people have gone to see Hamilton, which I think is wonderful because it really reconnects people to that time. And what's interesting is in that show, Jefferson is just this bundle of unpleasantries. He's vain. He's kind of silly. And I think that might overstate his weaknesses. But, I find him this gifted leader. Brilliant man in a lot of ways, but in many ways thin-skinned. He took criticism very personally, and like any human being, he had his strengths, he had his weaknesses.
as you were talking about his portrayal and the portrayal of him in Hamilton, we were receiving a tweet from someone asking that very question of what you thought of his portrayal. We've just gone through a very interesting, and that's a sort of understating it, political campaign in this country. Let's talk for a moment about his, was it 1804, battle against John Adams.
Oh, that 1800.
That was something for the ages, from what I read.
Oh, absolutely. And it's actually, he ran against Adams in 1796, a very close presidential election. And that's at a time when the person who received the second most number of electoral votes would become the vice president. Mm-hmm. So Adams gets elected president. His vice president was the man who ran against him, and bitterly so. And so Jefferson spends the Adams administration actively undermining the president who he's serving. And that sets the stage for this election of 1800, where he ends up defeating John Adams. But the real defeat has to be Aaron Burr, because their party, the Democratic Republicans, the Republican Party, it's not the same Republican Party as now, but it's the time often called the Republicans. Adams clearly is not going to win the election. But the election ends up getting thrown in the House of Representatives, who have to decide between Jefferson and Burr. And originally, Burr was supposed to shore up Northern support for the party, and Jefferson was the party candidate. And then when Burr announced that he wanted to be president, Jefferson felt completely betrayed, utterly betrayed. And, you know, the musical Hamilton actually gets it right, because at the end of the day, Hamilton's the one who helps tip the votes toward Jefferson. The 1796 and 1800 elections are really the elections that created partisan presidential elections. I had mentioned a colleague of mine. We're very lucky here in Missouri because we've got great historians. Jeff Pasley, who teaches at Mizzou, wrote a great book about the election of 1796, mm-hmm. which is the first kind of real presidential contest. And the 1800 election, it was bitter, it was divisive, it was confusing. But most importantly, it's part of the process through which we get a system of having two parties with each with a lead candidate. And that lays the foundation for the system that we have now.
And these campaigns are often pointed to today when people complain about the acrimony in our current politics. It's almost nothing compared to what was going on in these earlier times.
It's absolutely – yeah. The criticism that's heaped at these candidates is absolutely obnoxious. And when I say that's heaped at them, it's because it's at a time when the candidates themselves aren't really supposed to be participating in the election. You know, they're – other people do it for them. They don't want to claim that they're ambitious politicians. So they're kind of in an odd spot. They're kind of in a vice. They want to run their campaigns, but they can't be seen to do so.
You have to wonder what it might have been like with television and Twitter and all the rest of it a couple hundred years ago.
Well, and one thing we know about Jefferson, both Jefferson and Adams, neither of them was a good public speaker.
Really?
Both of them were magnificent writers. At a time when that's how people communicated.
How do we know they weren't good public speakers?
Because their contemporaries said so. they would say, Thomas Jefferson, he's no Patrick Henry, uh-huh. who's one of the great speakers.
Sure.
Or Fisher Ames, who no one's heard about now, but who is one of the great congressional speakers of his time.
A little over a minute left. I just want to not leave before we talk about the reconciliation between Thomas Jefferson and John Adams.
Yeah.
Very touching.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And of course, we're talking today about Jefferson's birthday, but there's this remarkable moment. Both men died on the same day, thinking the other was alive, and they did reconcile. And of course, that's this moment that a lot of Americans hold on to, and rightly so, which is that politics had really destroyed that friendship, but that Americans can reconcile despite their political differences.
One of the great, I guess you'd call it an irony of all of this too, is the fact that they died on the 4th of July.
They died on the 4th of July, 50 years after the Declaration of Independence. It's absolutely amazing.
you couldn't write it and have people believe it.
No, but it's true.
It is true. A final thought, a final word you want to leave us with regard to Thomas Jefferson?
I just think what amazes me is people keep studying Thomas Jefferson. People have rediscovered Alexander Hamilton. I think it's wonderful because – and I think it's great that people look at these strengths and these weaknesses. These were complex individuals. And what it reminds us of is, you know, we keep learning more about these guys because we keep studying them, and that's why people study them, and I think that's wonderful.
We certainly haven't forgotten them in this part of the country, that's for sure. Peter Castor, thank you so much. Always a great pleasure to talk to you about such things, and we'll hope to have you back again soon.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.